You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for another edition of Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. Let's start with some words from the Torah, the Devar Torah. We are currently in Parsha Yitro, Book of Exodus, and these comments that I'm about to read to you are by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, former Chief Rabbi of Great Britain, now of blessed memory. The Parsha of Yitro records the revolutionary moment when God, creator of heaven and earth, entered into a mutually binding agreement with a nation, the children of Israel, an agreement we call a brit, a covenant. Now, this is not the first divine covenant in the Torah. God had already made one with Noah, and through him all humanity. And he made another with Abraham, whose sign was circumcision. But those covenants were not fully reciprocal. God did not ask for Noah's agreement, nor did he wait for Abraham's assent. Sinai, however, was a different matter. For the first time, he wanted the covenant to be fully mutual, to be freely accepted. So we find that, both before and after the revelation at Sinai, God commands Moshe to make sure the people do actually agree. Now this point is fundamental. God wants to rule by right, not might. The God who brought an enslaved people to liberty seeks the free worship of free human beings. God does not act towards his creatures like a tyrant. This is a quote from Talmud, Avodah Zarah 3a. So, at Sinai was born the principle that was, millennia later, described by Thomas Jefferson in the American Declaration of Independence, the idea that governors and governments derived their just powers from the consent of the governed. God wanted the consent of the governed. That's why the Sinai covenant was conditional on the people's agreement. Admittedly, the Talmud questions how free the Israelites actually were, and it uses an astonishing image. It says that God suspended the mountain above their heads and said, "If you agree, well and good. And if you don't, here will be your burial." This is another topic for another time. Suffice it to say that there is no indication of this in the plain sense of the text itself. What is interesting is the exact wording in which the Israelites signal their consent. To repeat, they do so three times, first before the revelation, and then twice afterwards in the Parsha of Mishpatim. Listen to these three verses before the revelation. All the people answered as one and said, "All that God has spoken, we will do." The Hebrew is na'aseh. That's from Exodus, chapter 19, verse 8. And then afterwards, Moshe came and told the people all of God's words and all the laws. The people all responded with a single voice, "We will do," na'aseh again, "every word that God has spoken." That's Exodus chapter 24, verse 3. He took the book of the covenant and read it aloud to the people, and they replied, "We will do," once again, na'aseh, "and we will hear," venishma, "all that God has declared." Exodus chapter 24, verse 7. Note the subtle difference. In two cases, the people say, "All that God says we will do." In the third, the double verb is used, na'aseh ve'nishma, "we will do and we will hear," or obey or hearken or understand. The word Shema means to understand, as we see in the story of the Tower of Babel. Come, let us descend and confuse their speech, so that one person will not understand another's speech. That's from Genesis, chapter 11, verse 7. Note that there is clear that there is another difference between the three verses. In the first two cases, there is clear emphasis on the unity of the people. Both phrases are very striking. The first says, all the people answered as one. The second says, the people all responded with a single voice. In a book that emphasizes how fractious and fissiparous, as the people were, such declarations of unanimity are significant and rare. But the third verse, which mentions both doing and listening or understanding, contains no such statement. It simply says, they replied. There is no emphasis on unanimity or consensus. What we have here is a biblical comment on one of the most striking features in all of Judaism, the difference between deed and creed, between Asiyah and Shemiyah, between doing and understanding. Christians have theology. Jews have law. These are two very different approaches to a religious life. Judaism is about a community of action. It is about the way people interact in their dealings with one another. It is about bringing God into the shared spaces of our collective life. Just as we know God through what He does, so God asks us to bring Him into what we do. In the beginning, as Goethe put it, was the deed. That is why Judaism is a religion of law, because law is the architecture of behavior. When it comes, however, to belief, to creed, doctrine, all the things that depend on Shemiyah rather than Asiyah, understanding rather than action. On this, Judaism does not call for unanimity. Not because Judaism lacks beliefs. To the contrary, Judaism is what it is precisely because of our beliefs. Most importantly, the belief in monotheism, that there is, at least and at most, one God. The Torah tells us in Bereshit about creation, in Shemot about redemption, and in this week's Parsha about revelation. Judaism is a set of beliefs, but it is not a community based on unanimity about the way we understand and interpret those beliefs. It recognizes that intellectually and temperamentally we are different. Judaism has had its rationalists and its mystics, its philosophers and its poets, its naturalists and its supernaturalists. Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva, Judah Halevi and Maimonides, the Vilna Gaon and the Baal Shem Tov. We seek unanimity in Halacha, not in Agadah. Naaseh, we act in the same way, but Nishma, we understand each in our own way. That is the difference between the way we serve God collectively and the way we understand God individually. What is fascinating is that this is a well-known feature of Judaism already signaled in the Torah. In the difference between the way it speaks about Naaseh as one with a single voice, and Nishma, with no special collective consensus. Our acts, Naaseh, are public. Our thoughts, our Nishma, are private. That is how we come to service and serve God together, yet relate to Him individually in the uniqueness of our own individual being. There you have commentary by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks. Deed and Creed is how he titled that. This is from Parsha Yitro. Well, we read the book of Exodus. We read religious commentary. I read commentary every week, usually from Rabbi Sacks, but often by other people. And it has content, and it has meaning, it has significance. It's where Jews derive their essence, what it means to be a Jew, how we behave in the world, how we react with each other. There's a gentleman, his name is Leon Kass, who's a writer. He's dean of the faculty at Shalem College, professor emeritus in the college and the Committee on Social Thought at University of Chicago, and also a scholar emeritus at the American Enterprise Institute. He is a physician, a scientist, educator, and public intellectual. And he served from 2001 to 2005 as chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics. He's a quite learned man. And I'm going to devote a portion of the readings now and in the future on essays by Mr. Kass. And today I'm going to read some of his commentary on Exodus, the book of Exodus, and he comments in many ways. He comments on the religious, the political, the cultural matrix out of which Israel emerges, and the human alternative against which Israel will be defined. We see that playing out in the world today. It is most clearly represented in the events against Israel on October 7. I'm talking about the deed itself. I'm not necessarily talking about the propaganda and the deceit that follow it, although that certainly is a part of it. So I'll be reading excerpts from one of his book. It's a book on Exodus, Founding God's Nation. And he takes apart and analyzes and understands and explains one of the foundational texts of the Jewish tradition. Well, Jewish communities everywhere read the same parsha. It's the same every week, and we're reading in the book of Exodus now. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I commented on the parsha Vayera, and that parsha marked the beginning of when Moshe and Aaron are in Egypt and God's deliverance of the Israelites is beginning. It is underway. Dr. Kass, Leon Kass, asks two major questions about this political founding. How do the children of Israel, for now an oppressed multitude of slaves, become a free, self-governing people? And how does Moshe, for now a stranger in a strange land, come to be their leader and their founder? Both transformations require contact with and separation from Egypt, the world's premier civilization. So what I'm going to read to you next is Kass's description, a summary of the Egyptian way of life. And he starts with a question. What is Egypt? Egypt is not only the matrix out of which Israel emerges. It's also the human alternative against which Israel will be defined. Because Israel is to be the anti-Egypt, it is important to discover what Egypt is, its worldview, its politics, its way of knowing, its gods. The narrative of the plagues offers us wonderful material for considering these questions, though their secrets are difficult to extract. In a few cases, we're not sure what the plague really is. In each case, if we knew more about its explicit target, we could learn a lot more. To better prepare ourselves for learning about Egypt from the plagues, we should first collect things readers already know about biblical Egypt from Genesis and the first half dozen chapters of Exodus, supplemented by a few additions from outside sources. First, Egypt is the fertile land, the place of agricultural plenty, the place to which everyone turns when there is a famine. Its fertility is the gift not of heaven-sent rain, but of the Nile, which seasonally floods the land, nourishing each year's crop. Second, partly but not only for agricultural reasons, Egypt reveres the sun, which it treats as a god, Ra, the immortal and glorious source of light, warmth, and growth, indispensable to Egypt's prosperity. Whereas the Nile is a parochial deity, all Egypt's own worship of the sun expresses Egypt's opening to what is universal. The mind of Egypt is hardly insular. Third, along with the regular movements of the Nile, the seasonal revolutions of the sun, absolutely reliable, create the impression that the powers of nature are, at least in part, friendly to human life. Nature is cyclical, dependable, eternal, and to that extent worthy of reverence. Fourth, and on the other hand, Egypt is obsessed with decay and death, two massive and most unwelcome natural facts. It is culturally preoccupied, not with morality, but mortality, with the natural gods of life, health, fertility, ageless bodily beauty, and especially longevity. We recall from Genesis Pharaoh's impertinent question to Jacob on their first meeting, "How old are you?" Meaning, perhaps, "Are you older than me?" That's in Genesis chapter 48, verse 8 through 10. We recall also the pyramids, tombs of the pharaohs awaiting reanimation, and the Egyptian customs of embalming and mummification, practiced also on Jacob's beloved son Joseph, as reported in the very last words of Genesis. Fifth, we learn from extra-biblical sources that many natural beings are regarded in Egypt as emblems of natural powers or ideas, and are revered as deities for their support of the blessings of life, fertility, and longevity. The frog, for example, is an emblem of fertility, and the frog-headed goddess Hekat is revered for her influence on childbearing. The bull, Apis, is an emblem of masculine strength and potency. The cow is an emblem of birth and maternal nurture, and the cow-headed goddess Hathor is revered as the source of rebirth and rejuvenation. The scarab, or the dung beetle, is thought to emerge spontaneously out of excrement and is an emblem of immortality. The number of such emblematic creatures is very large, but they should not be confused with the anthropomorphic gods that Homer and Hesiod introduced into ancient Greece, gods that made the indifferent cosmos appear less alien to human life, interacted directly with particular human beings, and could be appealed to for personal assistance. The gods of Egypt are best seen as signs of natural powers crucial to human life and therefore worthy of awe and reverence. Sixth, an important corollary of this Egyptian polytheism is the low cosmic standing of humankind and human affairs. Human beings have no special or exalted status in the cosmic whole. Egypt does not look beyond nature to any transcendent source, one that would be the intelligent cause and author of nature, one in relation to whom human beings would have special standing. Their cosmology includes nothing able to correct the silence of nature and nature gods about justice and other ethical goods important to human beings. Egypt is poles apart from the biblical teaching that the human being is the most godlike. The Hebrew is Tselem Elohim, the most godlike of the creatures, higher than all the others, both on earth and in the heavens. Seventh, partly but not only because of the problems of decay and death, change is altogether unwelcome in the Egyptian mentality. The men shave their bodies and heads to remove evidence of aging, as did Joseph when, summoned from prison, he first came to Pharaoh. Egyptian hieroglyphs or ideograms are static representations of changing things. Stasis, or recurrent cyclical movement, that is changeless change, not progress in time, is the preferred idea in Egypt. Eighth, and very important, the emphasis on picture writing and visible forms is connected with the epistemic preeminence of the sense of sight. Seeing for the Egyptians is the royal road to knowledge, and seeing is believing. Pharaoh sees wonders, but does not listen to their voice or to the speech of Moses, and he forgets them when they disappear. In contrast, the Israelites will get their truths largely through hearing, through memory, and through stories. Ninth is the preeminence of technology, which goes beyond the very visible pyramids and storage cities. Although the public religion in Egypt officially worships nature and natural beings, the wise men of Egypt, working secretly in Pharaoh's palace, use their knowledge of nature to alter it, to make nature friendlier to human life. They develop secret arts, magic, and sorcery for controlling nature. And as we will see from the deeds of the magicians we soon meet, they are specially interested in finding ways to convert the lifeless into the living, and to reanimate the royal dead whom the palace physicians can only preserve from decay through embalming. And finally, Egypt is politically an autocracy, presided over by one man who is regarded as a god, and who rules according to his will and without external restraint. Egypt also boasts an elaborate and centralized administration, first introduced by Joseph, the father to Pharaoh, as he's known, which is itself another form of rational mastery over things. But Egypt lacks any real politics, that is, rules addressed to the souls of men. Administration and technology, not law and governance, are supreme. Not incidentally, most native Egyptians are also indentured servants of the Pharaoh, another of Joseph's gifts to a previous Pharaoh. Given the absence of a worldview in which human beings have a special relation to the divine, it is not surprising that Egypt practices a politics in which one man can lord it over everyone else, and other human beings count for little or nothing at all. As the contest with Pharaoh will make plain, his willful rule finally means accepting the destruction of the very people whose safety and well-being he presumably serves. So, what then is Egypt? We strongly suspect that the 10 features we've just listed are not unconnected qualities. Rather, they appear to be interrelated aspects of a way of life that rests on a coherent worldview, in which the cosmic powers appear to be hospitable but are finally indifferent to human life, in which human beings are orphans, lacking special standing or purpose, and in which, finally, only man, only the strongest man, can be a god, that is, an awesome benefactor to men. In subsequent passages, the Torah will sum up the meaning of Egypt in a single recurring epithet, the house of bondage, or slavery, the Beit Avodim, a house that is not a home, a bondage that enslaves not only the body, but also the mind, the heart, and the soul. Where people think that human life is unendowed, and only a powerful man can be a god to men. Slavery, the absence of freedom in all its forms, is the only logical outcome. Against this background, we can see more clearly why the contest of the plagues is at once political, epistemological, psychological, and metaphysical, theological. It is not merely a strategic device for weakening Egypt and enhancing Moses' standing so that he may better defeat Pharaoh and deliver the children of Israel from bondage. It is not merely a punitive system meant to dispense justice for Egyptian wrongdoing. And it is not merely a power struggle between the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and the Lord God of Israel. It is also and especially a program of education. It is a contest of ideas and worldviews about God, man, and nature, about rulers and ruled, and about knowing itself, that will reveal the truth of these matters to Moses and the children of Israel, to the surrounding world, and perhaps most especially to people that I'm speaking to readers of the text. Well, we'll hear more from Mr. Cass as we move along, but that's a bit of a taste, something I hope you find interesting. Let me just read a little more about him. This is a commentary that he has on the Ten Commandments. Oh, he doesn't refer to it as commandments. He calls it the Decalogue. And he's explaining a little bit about why it matters. He says, the biblical book of Genesis presents the story of how God's new way for mankind finds its first adherent in a single individual, Abraham, a man out of Mesopotamia, and how that way survives through three generations in the troubled households of Abraham, his son Yitzchak, Isaac, and his grandson Yaakov, Jacob, who is renamed Israel. By the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus, the children of Israel are settled in Egypt, a land of good and plenty, where they are soon teeming and prospering. Only a brief time thereafter to find themselves subjugated and enslaved. How this multitude becomes transformed into a people out of and against Egypt is the subject of Exodus and the following books. The central event in the national founding of the Israelite people is the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments. That happens in Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 14. Pronounced there by the Lord God to the assembled and recently liberated children of Israel, constitute the most famous teaching in the book of Exodus, perhaps the entire Hebrew Bible. Prescribing proper conduct towards God and man, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, embodies the core principles of the Israelite way of life, and later, of what would become known as the Judeo-Christian ethic. Even in our increasingly secular age, its influence on the prevailing morality of the West is enormous, albeit not always acknowledged or welcomed. Yet, despite its notoriety, the Decalogue is still only superficially known, in part because its very familiarity interferes with a deeper understanding of its teachings. Here, we are aspiring to such an understanding, and it intends to build a case for the enduring moral and political significance of the Ten Commandments. Now, I'm going to use his language, not the Ten Commandments, but the Decalogue, a universal significance that goes far beyond its opposition to murder, adultery, and theft. We can begin by correcting some common misimpressions, starting with the name Ten Commandments. Although most of the entries in the Decalogue appear in the imperative mode, thou shalt or thou shalt not, they are not called commandments, that is, mitzvot, but rather statements or words. For example, and God spoke all these words. Later in the Bible we hear about the ten words. In the Greek translation, which is Decalogoi, or Decalogue. But whether the reference is to these same statements is not obvious. No help is provided by counting. Traditional exegetes, people that argue and delve into these matters, derived as many as 13 commands from God's speech in Exodus chapter 20. And because internal divisions within particular statements are unclear, even those who agree on the number 10 disagree on how to count them. Furthermore, no mention is made in Exodus chapter 20 of the famous tablets of stone on which, in traditional imagery, we see the Decalogue inscribed, 5 statements on each. When such tablets are mentioned later on, we are not told what is written on them. What, then, do we know about the structure of these pronouncements? One group of them touches mainly on the relation between God and the individual Israelite. The first words spoken are, "I am the Lord, I am thy God." And within this group we hear the phrase, "the Lord thy God," 4 more times. The second group, beginning with, "thou shalt not murder," touches primarily on conduct between and among human beings. In this section, God is not mentioned, and the very last word of the Decalogue, "thy neighbor," marks a far distance from the opening, "I, the Lord." Next, nearly all the statements are formulated in the negative. The first few statements proscribe wrongful ways of relating to the divine. No other gods, no images, no vain use of the divine name, while the last 6 begin with, "lo," that is, "not." Human beings, it seems, are more in need of restraint than of encouragement. In this sea of prohibition, 2 positive exhortations stand out, the one about hallowing the Sabbath and the one about honoring father and mother. Hallowing the Sabbath is also one of 2 injunctions that receive the longest exposition or explanation. The other one concerns images and likenesses. Clearly, these 3 deserve special attention. But far more important than structural features is the context into which the Decalogue fits. This is the new people-forming covenant proposed by God through his prophet Moses to the children of Israel in the antecedent chapter of Exodus, chapter 19, verses 5 and 6. The overall terms of that agreement are succinctly stated. If the children of Israel, first, will hearken unto my voice, and second, keep my covenant, then as a consequence, first, ye shall be mine own treasure from among all peoples, and second, ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. It is only here, with the offer of a divine covenant, that this motley multitude of ex-slaves learns for the first time that they can become a people among other peoples of the earth, and that they can become a special people, a treasure unto the Lord. Moreover, their special place is defined in more than political terms. They are invited to become a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This is a matter to which we'll return later. Yet, the Decalogue is hardly the bulk of the Torah's people-forming legislation. All of the laws specifying proper conduct and religious observance come later, first in the ordinances immediately following the giving of the Decalogue, then in the laws regarding the building of the tabernacle, and then in the book of Leviticus, in the law governing sacrifices and the so-called holiness code. So the Decalogue functions rather as a prologue or preamble to the constituting law. Like the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, it enunciates the general principles on which the new covenant will be founded, principles that in this case touch upon and connect the relation both between man and God, and between man and man. It is less a founding legal code, more an orienting, aspirational guide for every Israelite, and perhaps every human heart and mind. Well, let's pause now from Mr. Cass and move on to some other topics. I hope you find what I've read so far to be interesting. I find it interesting. I think it'll be really quite revealing. So we'll keep moving. I just want to read something here. We're going to move to other matters, a little bit of politics here, a little about what's going on in the world today. The President of the United States issued an executive order today sanctioning Israeli citizens, persons, quote, persons undermining peace, security, and stability in the so-called West Bank, citing high levels of extremist settler violence, forced displacement of people, and villages and property destruction. There is no similar or corresponding sanctions on any Palestinian committing acts of terror against Israel. Well, all eyes, I think, will be on Bibi as the ink dries in Washington. Well, I just mentioned that. A little bit of context, a little bit of background. A lot of noise in the background. That's just a little bit of it. Kind of keep it in mind. The power of a presidential executive order lasts as long as that individual, that person, is in office, unless it's extended by a successor. But the real-life power of an executive order is best remembered all the way back to 1942, when FDR signed Executive Order Number 9066 that put American citizens of Japanese descent into holding camps. We didn't call them concentration camps. We called them holy camps during World War II. Well, we'll see the effect of this. Find it odd, don't you, that the President of the United States finds it necessary to sanction the best, the most committed, the strongest ally that the United States has? Okay, let's turn our subject attention now to Melanie Phillips, a British journalist and broadcaster and author. She writes her weekly column for the Jewish News Syndicate, and she's a columnist for the Times of London. She writes an essay where she says America and Britain cross a treacherous red line. Their unhinged obsession with the two-state solution threatens to incentivize Hamas. Fears that the Biden administration's bear hug of embattled Israel is the prelude to eating it alive were dramatically enhanced this week. On Wednesday, the State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said that the administration was actively pursuing the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with, ready for this, real security guarantees for Israel. He was confirming a report on the Hebrew language news site Walla that Secretary of State Blinken had ordered officials to examine the possibility of American and international recognition of a, ready, state of Palestine the day after the war in Gaza. A senior American official told the site that elements within the Biden administration are recommending a move towards recognizing a Palestinian state as a first step in a renewed peace process, not as the result of negotiations between the parties. These elements within the Biden administration appear to be in lockstep with the British government. 2 days before the report, at a reception in London, Britain's Foreign Secretary Lord Cameron stunned observers by declaring that the British government was considering formal recognition of a state of Palestine, including at the United Nations. It's been clear from the start of the war in Gaza that both Britain and America are seizing on the turmoil to advance their obsession with a two-state solution. However, it's one thing to press for movement towards a Palestinian state. Unilaterally recognizing it is something else entirely and crosses a red line. Official recognition of a Palestine that does not exist is part of the strategy of diplomatic warfare against Israel, promoted by those who want to see the Jewish state destroyed. Conceptually ridiculous, since it involves recognizing a state that has no physical form and no boundaries, It would remove at a stroke the necessity for the Palestinian Arabs to agree to live in peace alongside Israel. Instead, it would incentivize still further their rejection of Israel's right to exist. How exactly would such a state be demilitarized? Who would ensure that it had no access to weaponry that could threaten Israeli civilians? What exactly does the U.S. mean by real security guarantees for Israel? Is it suggesting these would be enforced by the Hamas-collaborating United Nations, maybe? Real security guarantees like UN Resolution 1701 in 2006? That one called for an area between the Israel-Lebanon border and the Litani River to be cleared of all armed forces other than the Lebanese army and UN peacekeepers. The area where Hezbollah has sighted 150,000 missiles, which it may unleash upon Israel any moment now, and from where it is launching daily attacks. Until now, Britain and America have rightfully opposed unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state as an act of malicious aggression against Israel. Now, they're proposing to join in. And what a time to announce this, when Israel is in the throes of a war for its existence after the worst slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust. While the IDF is making painful progress towards dismantling Hamas, Britain and America have now given the terror outfit an enormous incentive to keep fighting. Other remarks by Cameron were equally preposterous. He said that recognizing a state of Palestine would pressure Israel, which he blamed for the absence of such a state. The last 30 years, he asserted, have been a story of Israel's failure to provide security to its citizens by preventing a state of Palestine. This denies reality. The Palestinian Arabs have repeatedly been offered a state of their own, either by Israel or with its agreement, but have always turned it down and resorted instead to terrorism and war. The reason Israel has no security is because the UK, the US, and the European Union have mischaracterized the war of extermination against Israel as a conflict over territory. They have accordingly pressured Israel to make endless concessions that undermine its security. They have also continued to fund the PA, Palestinian Authority, despite the genocidal agenda against Israel and Jews that it shares with Hamas, and with which it indoctrinates the Palestinian Arabs with murderous hatred of the kind that erupted on October 7. Piously, Cameron also intoned that Israel would need to see all hostages released with a guarantee that Hamas can no longer launch attacks on Israel and with Hamas's leadership gone from Gaza. A guarantee from Hamas is absolutely a guarantee. Such a guarantee depends upon the destruction of Hamas as a military force, yet Britain and the U.S. are actively undermining this by their constant pressure on Israel to step up supplies of humanitarian aid to Gaza, some two-thirds of which, according to Israeli Security Agency Director Ronen Bar, is being stolen by Hamas for its own use. Both America and Britain have provided military aid to Israel. The resupply of weaponry from the U.S. is critical. The UK is sending an aircraft carrier to the region to replace the American one that is leaving. Both Britain and America spoke out against the vile South African genocide case at the International Court of Justice. Yet, in their obsession with a two-state solution as a path to peace in the Middle East, both Washington and London display quite staggering levels of political blindness and stupidity. They propose to declare the existence of a Palestinian state that the Palestinians have always rejected. They treat Hamas and a Palestinian state as if they are unrelated to each other. Get rid of Hamas and presto, a Palestinian state will end this 100-year war. But Hamas are Palestinians. They were joined in their atrocities on October 7 by hundreds of ordinary Palestinians from Gaza. The Palestinian Authority's governing party, Fatah, supported the pogrom. A Palestinian state would be Hamasistan on steroids and potentially run as such by Iran or Qatar. In the New York Times, Thomas Friedman, who is used as a conduit for the Biden administration's anti-Israel trial balloons, wrote that the proposed recognition of Palestine signals an awareness that the U.S. will never have the global legitimacy, the NATO allies and Arab and Muslim allies it needs to take on Iran in a more aggressive manner unless we stop letting Benjamin Netanyahu hold our policy hostage. This venomous distortion breathtakingly blames Netanyahu for fighting to defend Israel against genocidal Iran. Yet, it was the appeasement of Iran by Obama and Biden administrations that led to the October 7 pogrom. The unleashing of Iranian war across the region, and now three deaths and dozens of casualties among Americans. To imply that the Iranian regime, which screams death to America and aims to Islamize the world, is only waging this war because of the absence of a Palestinian state is as unhinged as it is disgusting. The Biden administration is riddled with vicious haters of Israel holding key Middle East policy positions. And, of course, Britain is the original cause of this conflict, having torn up its commitment under the Palestine mandate to settle the Jews throughout Palestine and offering part of it to their Arab attackers instead, the original two-state solution. In the 1930s, Britain's response to Palestinian Arab pogroms against Palestinian Jews was to reward the Arabs with a proposed state of their own. In 2024, Britain's response to a Palestinian Arab pogrom against Israeli Jews is to reward the Arabs with a state of their own. The supercilious Lord Cameron of Chipping Norton resembles nothing so much as a British colonial office poobah, busy selling the pass in mandatory Palestine while looking down his nose at uppity Jews. While Israel is forced to sacrifice the flower of its youth as it fights for its life, its so-called allies are placing the West itself in increasing peril as they threaten to hang the Jewish state out to dry once again to conceal their own malevolent bigotry and ineptitude. Well, hard to argue with her. Here's another. Biden and Blinken's disastrous plans. This is by Morton Klein, who is the national president of the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America. He says the administration's misguided idea of a Palestinian state would strengthen Iran and leave Israel weakened and encircled by Iranian proxy terror states and terrorist organizations. During his interview with U.S. Secretary of State Blinken in Davos, January 17, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman asked what a potential future book by Blinken would be named. Blinken answered, "Best Laid Plans," and laughed. How interesting. Did Blinken's answer reveal that deep down he knows that, especially regarding the Middle East? His and President Biden's plans epitomize the proverb, "The best laid plans of mice and men go oft ugly," that is, often go awry. Does he know that these plans are not even best laid plans? Biden and Blinken's plans over the last 3 years have repeatedly led to disaster. Failing to enforce sanctions gave Iran the funds to enrich proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the Houthis. Pressuring Israel to give up 330 square miles of maritime territory and valuable gas fields to Hezbollah-controlled Lebanon strengthened Hezbollah, which is now raining rockets down on northern Israel, displacing over 80,000 Jews. When Hamas launched 4,500 rockets at Israel in May of 2021, the administration's pressure on Israel to end the ensuing 10-day war before Israel could wipe out Hamas's rockets, tunnels, and terror infrastructure enabled Hamas to commit the October 7 massacre. Biden's removal of the Iranian-backed Houthis from the U.S. Foreign Terrorist Organization's list 3 years ago over the objections of Middle Eastern allies, which resulted in the removal of accompanying sanctions, was yet another mistake. It strengthened the Houthis' ability to attack U.S. interests, which it's doing right now. It's our allies in international shipping. On January 17, the Biden administration was forced to put the Houthis on the U.S. specially designated global terrorist groups list. Blinken and his latest plans will likewise lead to disaster. These include their plans, pressure, and absurd demands for the terrorist Palestinian Authority to rule Gaza, a stronger reformed Palestinian state. He says, limitations on Israel's war to eradicate Hamas, sending dual-use material to Gaza under the guise of humanitarian aid, giving more funds to UNRWA, the Hamas-controlled agency of the UN that hides Hamas's weapons and teaches Palestinian children to kill Jews, preventing Palestinians from leaving Gaza and returning hostile Palestinians to Israel's Gaza border. All of this can only lead to more Arab terror and more October 7s, which Hamas is threatening to commit. Not threatening, promising to commit. Look at the events of last week. After Israel withdrew its 36th Division from Gaza, under pressure from Biden and Blinken, Hamas immediately moved in and used the vacated area to fire large barrages of missiles into Israel. Blinken's promotion of the Biden administration's misbegotten plans reached a new crescendo during his Davos interview. Blinken said that the U.S. and Arab and Muslim countries hold the absolute conviction that normalization with Israel has to include a pathway to a Palestinian state, and insisted that a Palestinian state has to be part of the equation, and falsely portrayed Israel as the obstacle to peace without mentioning ongoing Hamas rocket attacks and daily terror attacks perpetrated by Palestinian Arabs in Judea and Samaria, or the fact that approximately 80% of Palestinian Arabs support Hamas and support the October 7 massacre. Blinken absurdly claimed that Israeli capitulation to a Palestinian state would somehow isolate Iran and its proxies and give Israel the security it needs. In reality, if a Palestinian state, especially a stronger one, is part of the equation, this will strengthen Iran and its proxies, leaving Israel weakened, isolated, and at greater security risks. Israel will be encircled by Iranian proxy terror states and terror organizations like Hezbollah, Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and many more. There's dozens of these little proxy terror groups that Iran has created everywhere they can to isolate Israel. Iran's terrorist Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, is likely to quickly establish bases in a Palestinian state, just as they have done in Syria. Iran will also arm a Palestinian state to the teeth, just as Iran has armed Hamas. PIJ and Hezbollah. Hezbollah has close to 200,000 missiles pointed at Israel and is launching them at Israeli communities every day. A Palestinian state will make this situation far worse. Israel will face constant rocket and terror attacks from all sides. No normalization with an Arab or Muslim state will change the reality that an encircled Israel would ultimately be indefensible. Blinken is also wrong that Arab and Muslim states have an absolute conviction that there must be a pathway to a Palestinian state. Arab and Muslim states want strong allies against Iran, not an ally that is weakened, encircled, and constantly fighting for its life while subjected to terror and missile attacks from all sides. In other words, the Blinken-Biden plan for a strong Palestinian state is a disaster in the making. Moreover, during his Davos interview, Blinken once again failed to mention even a single Palestinian reform that could bring peace. For example, he never mentioned ending the PA's pay-to-slay program, which rewards Arab terrorists who murder Jews. And he never mentioned reforming the PA and UNRWA schools and textbooks that teach Palestinian children to grow up to murder Jewish children. He never mentioned changing the names of schools, streets, sports teams, and children's camps that are named after Palestinian Arab Jew killers, and never mentioned ending the nonstop drumbeat of incitement against Jews and Israelis by the PA. Blinken's only planned reform was a vague statement about a Palestinian authority that can more effectively deliver for its own people. Deliver what? More hate-filled indoctrination. It's time for Biden and Blinken to adopt better plans, such as denazifying the PA, changing the anti-Semitic textbooks, stopping imams' sermons calling for the murder of Jews, and demanding an end to the PA's policy of honoring terrorists and terrorism and paying them. This type of program transformed the Germans after World War II, and it can transform the Palestinian terrorist regime today. Well, that's Morton Klein from the Zionist Organization of America, the ZOA. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I notice that we are running out of time, so I want to thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. I hope you found today's program interesting. And in parting, I'd like to wish all of you a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavua Tov. Have a good week.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.